From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection for this hour was made in 2001 when a woman named Elizabeth McGriff bought a home on Cedarwood Terrace in Rochester. The price on that home, $56,000. McGriff made payments over much of the next decade, totaling, well, just about $100,000. But the Democrat and Chronicle reports that McGriff still had payments due and had encountered some financial troubles during the nation's economic downturns. Well, last summer, facing eviction, she received support of a local group called Take Back the Land. The group views housing as a human right, and they fight evictions that they find unjust. In McGriff's case, the lender offered to sell her back her house. Now, remember, the 2001 sale price, $56,000. The new assessment was for $73,000. McGriff had paid $100,000 over the years, and the bank said she could have it for $130,000. Take Back the Land says that's a common occurrence around Rochester. People are hurting, struggling. These kind of eviction notices are happening. They'd like to see new policies to protect good faith homeowners in hard times. And the group's also concerned about so-called zombie properties and the city of Rochester's approach to that issue. So this hour, a conversation about housing as a right or a privilege, and what happens when someone can't pay. All of my guests are in some way or another with the organization Take Back the Land. Let me welcome them now. Julie Gelfand is here. Julie, nice to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Ryan Acuff is here as well. Ryan, nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
And Elizabeth McGriff, who I just mentioned, nice to see you. Thanks for being here. And Barbara Horton is here as well. Hi, Barbara. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, Elizabeth, I want to start. Did we get the story roughly correct there? Okay, we're making sure that we've got your mic working, so why don't you hold on for 1 second. And for what we're going to do is we're going to circle back to Elizabeth's story, but what I want to do, I think, is let our listeners kind of know what sparked this conversation. And it really started just over 2 weeks ago when Mayor Lovely Warren was on this program. The mayor was talking about a number of issues. We did talk about some housing issues, and here is what happened there. I asked her about the vacant property that used to be owned by Assemblyman David Gant. And here's the timeline as reported by the Democrat and Chronicle then. Assemblyman David Gant walked away from a rental property. It became what some refer to as a zombie property, and it became the responsibility of the taxpayers. But no one was mowing the lawn or fixing it up, and the grass got really high. You might remember that columnist Dave Andriotta made a show of mowing the lawn. Anyway, it was the city's problem now. Then Assemblyman Gant applied for a grant from the city to spruce up another house that he owns, and despite his ownership history, the city said yes. And he received a grant for more than $36,000 to improve that property. So after he left the house for taxpayers to take care of, the city decided taxpayers should give him $36,000 for a different house. I asked Mayor Warren that day if the city's Office of Public Integrity should investigate that situation, and here's what she said.
Actually, I think that the Office of Public Integrity did investigate that.
They did.
And they found that there was nothing wrong with a citizen, a private citizen, that taking advantage of a grant that the city had that anyone could take advantage of. I think that that was clearly discussed here on this program as well. It was investigated. Someone on City Council had raised the issue, and the OPI director had taken a look at it and had made a determination.
You didn't have any trouble with David Gant walking away from that property?
Walking away from what property?
The property that became essentially a zombie property that the Democrat and Chronicle had a couple of stories on. You're not familiar?
No, I'm familiar, but I'm trying to figure out what exactly are you trying. What's the question?
I'm trying to understand if you have a problem with what the assemblyman did in that particular case.
We have people that walk away. This is the thing about it. You have people that walk away from properties in our community all the time for various reasons. It's a business decision. It's a they have invested a lot of money and they feel like, you know, I can't invest any more money because of for whatever reason. There are things that, decisions that people make all the time. So I don't know, you know, why the assemblyman did what he, you know, felt was necessary to do for his business, and he's well within his right to do that. Any person that purchases a property in our city, I would want them to make sure that it's fixed up. I would want them to make sure that it is, you know, a great property. But I can't tell people what to do and not do with their property and make business decisions on that.
All right, that's Mayor Lovely Warren. 2 weeks ago on this program, we reached out to City Hall this week to find out if they wanted to come back on the program and follow up or respond to some of what you're about to hear from the Take Back the Land group, but they said no one was available to join us today. But that was the start of my interaction with Take Back the Land, because at that point, Julie emailed me to say that you had some trouble with what you just heard. So why don't you elaborate on what bothered you about what you just heard from Mayor Warren?
I was actually shocked, and that response is so much not about what the needs of our city is at this point. And so let me point out some statistics. 75% of all foreclosed homes in the city are investor-owned homes, as this was. And of the almost a third of investor-owned homes are vacant. Mr. Gant's home, vacant home, is only one of many. And to say that this is okay as a business decision is saying that all of those vacant investor homes are really just business decisions. And that's not what our city needs right now. We need to make decisions based on the needs of our community, not the individual investor.
Looking at nationwide on the trends, Realty Track, as Julie has pointed out, Realty Track tracks these kind of property ownerships and statuses. And their latest numbers, February 2016, Realty Track reports that 76.7% of all vacant properties nationwide are investment properties, like this one. So the vast majority of what you would call zombie properties are investment properties, probably not unlike the situation in which Assemblyman Gant walked away from it. But Julie, the mayor, is saying he does have a right as a business owner to do that. He didn't break a law. He didn't do anything technically wrong. What would you have wanted her to say?
I would want her to say that he needs to take responsibility for anything that concerns the health of our neighborhoods. And he clearly did not do that. If there were things he could have done earlier on, he made decisions to allow that house to be empty, to not have anybody living in it. One of the things that one of the suggestions that Empire Justice has made in their report Eye on the Storm is that the best way to prevent houses from going down is to keep them occupied. And he chose not to do that, and by doing that, he needed to make repairs on his home. He chose not to make repairs on his home by allowing it to be empty. They probably had copper stolen. It became a place that was unfixable. He made choices along the way that were bad choices.
Now, I certainly can't speak for him. If I recall correctly, he made it clear that he didn't just walk away for no reason, that he had tried, that he had done his best. So if he's saying, I've tried to get it rented, I didn't want it to go in that direction, but I had to walk away, I had no other alternative, what should he have done? Should he have made it offered to people who needed housing for free or for a very low rate? Or, you know, he may have said, I can't afford to do that. What would you say, Julie?
Well, one of the things that we as a group can talk about today is community land trusts. He could have donated it to a community land trust, and the house therefore could have been fixed up and could be used by someone we have many homeless people in this city. It could be a housing first house where someone who needs a home would have some place to stay. There are a lot of uses that could have been made. Instead, the house ended up being torn down by the city at a cost of over $20,000.
In this case, then, Julie, what's the process like? If it becomes a housing first house or a community, what's the term again? He could have donated it to the
A community land trust.
A community land trust. Okay. How many houses are with the community land trust, for example, right now?
None.
Okay.
Yes, that's why. That's one of the reasons we're here. We want to talk about the concept and the idea of a community land trust. We do have a land trust formed, but we now are waiting for donated houses.
Okay, so his would have been the first.
It could have been the first.
So you can't blame the assemblyman for not getting on a bandwagon there that didn't exist yet. But do you think he knew that this was an option?
This is an option he had to be aware of. Land trusts are community land trusts. Have a long history.
Okay. Before I get to the phones are already ringing. People want to weigh in on these issues. The broader issue here, we're not going to talk about David Gant's house for the hour. We've talked enough about that. We're talking about housing in general in the city, and housing, you know, as this group views it, as a human right. Fair enough, Julie? Yes?
Absolutely.
Okay. So The reason we wanted to start there, though, was the mayor's comments. I think there are a lot of people who hear that and say that they understand what she's saying, that that if somebody has done their best with that kind of a property, they may not be aware of that as an option, as a community land trust. But if you are successful in convincing more people to do that, how many houses do you need? How many could become community land trust houses, for example?
I don't know if it's how many can become, because that's something we would actually have to investigate. But in order to make an effective neighborhood-controlled community, we're looking at, and actually we were doing some research right now on what would that percentage be, but we're thinking somewhere between 15 and 30% of the homes in any area, if they are part of a community land trust, that will bring power to those neighborhoods.
Okay, and who manages the homes in that scenario?
The land trust itself, which would be controlled by the community.
Okay. And so do you need a board or a set of volunteers?
There would be both.
Okay. How quickly do you think you could get that together? I mean, do you have people lined up and willing to do it right now?
Yes.
Yeah?
We do. We have a land trust. It's called the, I'm going to mess it up and Ryan
okay.
can fix it, but it's called the Umaja. Thank you.
Umaja. Okay.
Land Trust, and it has been formed. We have our primary contact for that group, and we are willing and able to take any homes that are donated to it.
Okay, so you're ready and you're willing to do that. If I'm somebody who needs housing in a community land trust house, what is the process of getting that housing? How long can I be there? Can you kind of give me the broad parameters there?
I can and can't, because
okay.
that's something that would be determined by the land trust itself. And being that we're in the birth stage here,
sure.
I can't do that.
I won't hold you to every detail, but
right.
you can help me kind of envision
what,
how it works.
So, however, let's take Elizabeth and Barbara as examples.
Sure.
The banks that they that own their homes could make a decision to donate those homes to the land trust rather than they can elaborate more on their stories.
Mm-hmm.
In doing that, if the land trust now owns the home, the land trust would own the land itself that the house is on, and then decide, well, what are we going to do with the house? They can then sell the house. The land trust can sell the house itself to the homeowner. So we might sell the house back to Elizabeth, but it would be at a price that she could afford, in terms that she could afford. So we would be making it a win-win situation for her. She would have her home back, and she would not run into financial issues like she has in the past. On the other hand, the way it will benefit the community is that part of the contract in buying this house would be that the land trust has control over what it can be sold for in the future. So and owning the land, we would have control over that. So in doing that, it would enable the house to stay affordable, because if she were to sell the house again in the future, she could only reap certain benefits, and the house would have to stay affordable so that the community could always be, it would be in the community for anybody who needs it.
Are there other cities that have land trusts? Rochester doesn't, if you missed Julie
Not
mentioning
yet.
That. But are there other cities that have this?
There are. Burlington, Vermont has a very well-established land trust. And I think Ryan can give you names of other cities.
Yeah, Ryan?
Yeah, can I just back up?
Absolutely.
Because I think it's a new concept for a lot of people. So I just want to say a little bit about. So community land trusts have been around, started in the 1960s to prevent black farmers in Georgia. And became an urban concept in the 1980s, starting in Cincinnati, and now in 220 cities across the country. So it's not a new or particularly novel concept, but real established, as Julie said. In Burlington, the Champlain Community Land Trust has thousands of units within it, very well-developed ones in Boston, Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. And basically, this is a way to bring more democratic community control over community decisions. The land trust board, as you mentioned, is made up of people who live on the land, community members, as communities define, whether it's Beechwood, 14621, the city of Rochester, however you define the community, and other agencies that have the same mission for permanent affordable housing. And so it's a way of bringing people together. It's kind of a cooperative dealing with land. And then it's also a way of making the housing permanently affordable. So one can resell a house or a building or a unit, but just based on the price of what the land trust resale formula is, not based on the market. So the current system, the dominant economic system, is everything's controlled by the market. The problem with that is for the people with the least money, wealth, and power are getting more and more disempowered. 3 million homeless in the United States, thousands in Rochester, and the people with the most money, wealth, and power being benefiting for that. But we need a system that benefits everybody. And that's why some people say, well, the choice is between complete market control or complete state control or government control. And we say there's actually a third alternative, and that's community control, and that residents can come together, cooperate, keep the wealth, keep the benefits in their own community, and keep their housing permanently affordable. And we think community land trust is one of many things. It's not a silver bullet that's going to solve all issues, but it's one of many ways to organize the neighborhoods more effectively to create permanent affordable housing. And because we've got major, major housing issues, housing is majorly unaffordable, especially for communities of color. So HUD says the standard for affordable housing in the United States is 30% of your income towards housing. Well, in Rochester, white families spend in general 33% of their income on housing, but black families spend 55% of their income on housing. So it's completely unaffordable. So obviously the current system of the market's not working for black families and Latino families as well. So we need something that can be affordable and build up wealth from there. So we're hoping some of these initiatives that are coming in, like the Anti-Poverty Initiative and these other initiatives, where we're promising massive investments in neighborhoods. We say, yes, we need these investments, but we need it to keep in the neighborhood. So it's actually employing people in their own neighborhoods, and it's not raising property value so people are priced out of their own neighborhoods. And we think that the land trust can be one way to have development without displacement.
We're going to get to your phone calls, and we're going to hear some personal stories on what Barbara and Elizabeth have been going through. I just want to make sure before we move forward, we kind of clear up any other confusion. So if this land trust happens, do you need approval from the city of Rochester? Do you need a partnership in any ways? Has the city been communicating with you on this?
So it's not necessary to, it's not approved by necessarily the city, but certainly we want partnership with the city land bank. We think that the properties that go through the city land bank, so just to clarify, so a land bank is controlled by a municipality like the city of Rochester, and a land trust is controlled by the community. But we want to partner with the land bank because historically land banks are very good at acquiring land, but bad at preserving it. And land trusts have a harder time acquiring land, but good at preserving it. So we think if the city and community-controlled institutions like land trusts work together, it's really good for everybody.
Okay, I reached out to the city of Rochester, and they did not have anyone available to join this conversation today. Julie, kind of a wry smile from you on that. Is there something that I don't want to read too much into that, but can you tell me how you your view on the city and communicating with them?
Thanks. We have been trying to get the city to work with us, and for some reason we're having a difficult time having them sit down at the table to discuss options. And so, yes, my response was not surprised.
That they couldn't be here today. Are you frustrated with that?
Definitely frustrated with that. I think that we have a lot of good conversations, and we have had support from various people at City Hall, but just not from the mayor's office.
Okay. Well, I open the hour with a conversation about Elizabeth's story. And Elizabeth, again, in 2001, moved into a home on Cedarwood Terrace. And tell me about the house and how things were going, and then what happened for you, Elizabeth.
Well, it was my first opportunity to own a piece of property, and I bought it in 2001, like you said, and it was a place for my kids to grow up, something for my family, to really connect with. And fell on hard times in 2012. I got hurt on the job and was let go. Tried to seek a different venue of a different field of work. And because of the time period, it was hard to find employment. So was given several reasons why they couldn't set up a modification. One was because I was on unemployment. So then I got employment, And still in 2013, they went ahead with the foreclosure, even when I had financial, you know, stability to pay a mortgage. So the bank, you know, really didn't work with me at that point. They were just, you know, it was in the court system, went through the court system, had help with the housing council to work out a budget, to see if they could do a budget, and found out my house was already on the auction block and was going, you know, through being auctioned off.
This was in 2013
This was in 2013, 2014.
Okay, and to be clear, how much did you have left to pay on the house?
I'm not exactly sure how much was still left.
It was a $56,000 mortgage.
Okay.
In 2001, is that correct?
Right.
Okay. And the Democrat and Chronicle reported that you had made payments totaling around $100,000, of course, with escrow, with interest.
Interest. Yeah, and yeah, majority of that went for interest right. in the bank's pocket.
So we don't know how much principal was left, but there was still some left. And the bank decided at that point they wanted to go ahead in the way that they did. So what's happened since then?
I think it was in April, the bank came with about 30 sheriffs, police officers and sheriffs. And they basically moved my stuff out of the home and put it in storage. And basically right now I'm homeless. I'm living with relatives, but I don't have that place of comfort that, you know, that I wanted. And I'm kind of just, you know, going with things as trying to pick up the pieces and go move forward.
Elizabeth, who was living in that house before they went and took your stuff and... Who was living there?
Me and my son.
You and your son?
Yes.
Okay.
I know in the paper they did say that I had moved out. I've never moved out of my home.
Okay.
I've always lived there throughout the duration.
But you've been out of that house since when?
For about, it was April 5th was the date that they removed everything. So it's been since that time period.
Okay. And... What are you going to do next?
Well, my hope is to gain community support to renegotiate with the bank to see if they will be willing to donate it, or if they do, you know, send the property back to FHA to donate it to a land trust. That's my hope. And
yeah, okay. Well, you might have seen her story told in the Democrat and Chronicle or in other places, and you might see pictures of, or maybe you're driving by and you occasionally see people literally standing and saying, we will not allow this eviction to take place. And Ryan, can you let our listeners know when these events are happening, when eviction may be coming, there are people, and I think you've been there yourself, right, where you say, we're not going to allow this to happen. We're willing to be arrested for this. Yes.
Yeah. As we said, we think housing is a human right, and this crisis of mass displacement in Rochester and beyond is completely preventable. So it's not as if there aren't alternatives. It's not as if the bank couldn't work things out. You know, these banks were all bailed out for the purpose of keeping people in their homes, but instead they took the money and the homes. So it'd be like going down to the corner store, trying to buy a Coke, and to say you pay the cashier and they say, actually, I'm going to keep the money and the Coke. And we said, you can't have it both ways. If you're going to take our money, you can't take our homes. And in this case, and many cases, the banks are actually incentivized to foreclose. So in this case, it's an FHA mortgage. And the reason they're charging so high for her to try to buy the house back is because the government is going to pay them if the house becomes vacant. So they win either way. Right. So they aggressively went to foreclose because they could get the FHA insurance check from the government. So we're very concerned about this system and how it's rigged. And either way, the banks are winning. And either way, basically, even if someone stays in their house, they're paying exorbitant interest. And so we think sometimes we have to take a stand because we think it's a moral issue. And this is going to continue the inequality and the poverty in Rochester is going to get deeper and deeper unless people take a stand. They say no more. And we have to come together and organize to say, what do we want and how are we going to get it? And the people are going to ultimately have to do it. We can't just wait for something to happen. We can't just wait and hope the government's going to solve everything. I think we have to organize and tell the government and the institutions and the banks and all of the community what we want, and we're going to have to fight to get it, because it's not going to come easy, because, you know, these problems have been a long time coming, the structural racism and exploitation in Rochester, and we're going to have to really fight hard in order to turn it around.
Louise, Mary, and Richard, hang in there for one more minute, because I want Barbara Horton to make sure we get her story in as well. Barbara Horton has been here as well. And can you tell us your story, Barbara?
My husband and I purchased our home in 93, which is a very comfortable home. I love the area. It's not a lot of noise. And I feel comfortable in my home. My husband got sick, and he passed away in January 2003. After that, I got a job, which I had been working like in between, you know, times. And he passed, and I managed to pay the mortgage for over 10 years, plus raising our six-year-old son from that up through graduation and everything, which was very hard for me as a single mom. And I fell behind in my mortgage when I became disabled from a car accident, which I'm still not able to work now. And I tried to, you know, talk with the bank and everything. The mortgage was in my husband's name. It was not in my name. It was in his name. So the bank at first didn't want to talk to me about this situation. My son had to go to surrogate court to sign papers for them to talk to me about the situation. And what we did, we submitted modification papers. That I believe that was in 13. And after they got the papers and everything, then before I received a letter from them, and they were stating that they had received my modification papers and they were reviewing them. But before I received that letter, I also received a letter for the sale of the house, which at the auction, it was not auctioned off. It went back to Fannie Mae. So there's two things going at one time. They're reviewing my modification papers at the same time that they're auctioning off their home. And to me, I feel like that was unfair, because somebody was, at some point, was not communicating. Because the date that my modification papers were submitted, that was the same date that was on the letter that I received for the sale of the home.
And where do things stand now?
Right now, I'm facing eviction. And I would like for the bank or Fannie Mae to work with me, because there are options out there that a lot of people don't know about. A lot of people walk away from their homes because of fear, because of shame, because of pride. And some people, they don't know that they have options other than just to pack up and leave. But that is not my intent. I'm going to stay there. I'm going to stick it out until there's no option.
Barbara, you probably know that there are some listeners who are going to think that the idea of housing as a human right is too much, that your story, Elizabeth's story, many stories like it, are occasionally sad, but sometimes they say, well, you're asking for something that if you can't pay, then you shouldn't be in that house, and that maybe you just don't want to pay. What would you say to people who think you don't want to pay?
It's not that I don't want to pay. I believe that I have enough income for the banks to negotiate with me. They sent me a letter. They offered me the house for $50,000. When I fell behind, I believe my mortgage was at, I think I owed like $39,000, maybe pretty close to $40,000. So they offered me the house back for $50,000. They wanted me to pay 10% down within 9 days after accepting their offer, and the balance within 30 days. I asked them if they could go back to try to negotiate something more affordable that I could do. Then they came back and said, well, we'll just offer you the house for a $50,000 lump sum. That is not a more negotiable solution.
You're saying that's not a good faith offer. They know exactly. They know you can't afford that.
Right. So I know it's something out there that can be done for myself and my son to remain in my home. There's other options.
Okay. Ryan, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so what we found over and over is in the dark of night, people are being pushed out of their homes en masse. Since 2008, about 11 million people have been displaced through bank foreclosure. If we think about those numbers, those are at the scale of larger than some of the greatest wars of our generation, the wars in Iraq, Syria. That many people have been displaced. And this is happening right here in the United States. And this isn't an unnatural disaster. This is designed through really specific government policies which incentivize and promote these bank foreclosures. And there are other options in these cases. So people say, we do hear this sometimes, people say, well, people don't want to pay. Or people say, why don't you pay their bills? And our response is, well, if you would let them, they would. The banks aren't accepting payments from Liz and from Barbara because they're aggressively foreclosing so they can collect their government welfare check from the banks. So this is what gets missed, and sometimes it's not talked about in the media, is how they're incentivized. This isn't an accident. Some people say, oh, the banks, they don't want to be landlords. They don't want to foreclose. Well, they foreclose if that's how they make the biggest profit, and that's how they're making the biggest profit, through the government backing 85% of the mortgages in the way they are in the country.
Okay. I'm late for a break. Let's take our only break of the hour. Let's come back and get your phone calls. And there are many phone calls. People wanted to weigh in on these subjects as we talked to Julie Gelfand and Ryan Acuff, Elizabeth McGriff, and Barbara Horton about home ownership as a right in the city of Rochester. The conversation continues next. Coming up in our second hour, it's the College of Collectible Knowledge. They're back, and it's your chance to call with questions about antiques you might have, knickknacks, items in the house, something you found in the attic or an estate sale. You want to know, what is it exactly? What might it be worth? Where might it be from? The College of Collectible Knowledge will help tell you next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and a lot of folks have been waiting to join the conversation. So let me start with Louise in Rochester first up. Go ahead, Louise.
Hi there. Listen, in the city, normal people like me who actually live in their homes, we have most of our savings in our homes. And every time one of these properties goes empty because the bank wants to get this payment that Ryan was describing, we all on the street take a 15% hit in our property value. I don't know why people aren't going wild about this. How the heck can the police throw people out of their houses who can afford to pay for it like Elizabeth? You know, the police don't even show up in other jurisdictions. You know, like Cook County in Chicago. If the police didn't show up, the banks would have to talk to Liz. They'd have to talk to these other people. And, you know, the thing is, you know, Lovely Warren, Mayor Warren, has known about this for years. She knew about this when she was on the city council. I mean, so the banks are getting wealthy. She is hitting actual people who live in their houses. She is really hitting our bottom line. This is ridiculous. I want to know why she's not doing something about this, and I want to know why good, decent people like Liz and her son, who can pay, are getting thrown out by the police. If the police stayed out of it, they'd have to deal with those banks that are three states away would have to deal with the homeowner. So I want to know. And, you know, Lovely's been on the council. She knew about this. We got a brand new police chief who is from here. Oh, he's a great guy. He's supposed to know about this. Oh, no. They just, like, you know, the minute he came into office, this just went on a pace, throwing, you know, disabled people, good neighbors out of their houses. I'm disgusted. I'm just absolutely disgusted, and I cannot believe that this is happening to people in Rochester, and this is happening to this city. I really, you know, the fact that the Warren, Lovely Warren, wouldn't even send somebody to talk on this program. I mean, who do they think they are?
All right, well,
what do they think is going on here? This is really costing people who are investing, homeowners who are investing in the city of Rochester, 15% in the value of the house. I want an answer.
All right, Louise, I've got to let the panel respond. Thanks for the phone call. And I want to stress again, we did reach out to City Hall, and Lovely Warren's administration has been accessible on many, many issues for this program. I certainly wouldn't say otherwise on many issues. If the mayor can't come, a representative in various parts of the city is able to come. They said today they didn't have anyone available to join this conversation. Okay, so Louise is fired up. We heard that. Julie, you want to just, I'll start with you. You want to weigh in on some of what you heard? Go ahead.
Hi, Louise. So I hear what you say, and of course I agree, and it would be really wonderful if the police decided to just completely lay off and say, well, we're here to protect the people. That means we're not going to show up because we're not protecting the bank. We're protecting the neighbors. Unfortunately, what's in our discussions with the police, what they have told us is that they are the servants of the court. And if the court tells them they have to do it, they will do it, and they will do it hopefully in the most benign way. Unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. And in the long run, what we do want is cooperation with our justice system in order to help our neighborhoods, and that would include working with the police.
Okay. Let me get back to the phones, and next up is Mary in the city of Rochester. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I had a comment leading into a question. I guess I understand that the average foreclosure takes maybe 3 to 5 years, and maybe a house is vacant for a good portion of that. Meanwhile, a sump pump is not running because the electricity is off. If it's not winterized, the pipes are freezing, and so on and so forth. And with the land trust they're talking about, would those things be maintained? Would power be left on so sump pumps could run, things like that?
Ryan, go ahead.
Well, for one, there's been a lot of studies and showing on foreclosures and land trusts, and housings that are in land trusts have a dramatically low rate of foreclosure. So one is the payments are more affordable, and being a part of a community organization where everybody has a stake in it, so it tries to prevent those in the first place. But yes, if something were to fall into that type of situation, there are, since there's a whole stake in it and keeping up the houses, yes, those issues can be addressed. And there's typically repair reserve funds as people pay into a fund that's for the whole land trust. So it benefits everybody. So people fall on hard times that, especially the bigger the land trust, the more financing, but people can help with repairs and keeping up the houses in those situations.
Did I answer your question, Mary?
Yeah, I guess I had another quick question. I'm wondering why banks, or there isn't some kind of, ruling or law that they're making plenty of money off the interest. Why, when a house goes into foreclosure, can't they just keep the power on at a minimum heat and, things like sump pumps? Because for instance, I just went to look at a house, and it was foreclosed on, and, of course, there's 2 feet of water in the basement. So, who wants to buy something with 2 feet of water in the basement at whatever cost? There's going to be damage, So I guess I was just wondering if that's a practical thing that the banks would be forced to keep electricity on for, basic things to stop the house from warping or rotting or so on and so forth.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. Yeah, thanks very much. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's very practical. I mean, even if a house is going vacant, the bank has a huge stake in it, and they're getting a lot of money from the foreclosure, and they could keep it up, and it's really in the neighborhood's best interest.
Okay, I know Elizabeth wanted to weigh in on some of what you heard earlier, so before I jump back to the phones, and every phone line is lit up here, we're going to get through as many calls as we can this hour. Elizabeth, go ahead. Something else you wanted to weigh in on what you heard earlier?
Well, I just wanted to talk about my particular bank was MidFirst Bank, and since the foreclosure crisis, they have increased. The bank has increased from millions to billions, so they're making money on this. And the people that are suffering are people in the community. So I think the more people and the more support we can get towards the land trust would be a positive for our community. We're talking people controlling or, having a stakehold in their property, in their community, rather than being having it in the hands of bankers who really don't care about what our what happens in our community.
Julie?
I want to give a little background on MidFirst Bank. MidFirst is located in, it's actually one of the largest banks in the, privately owned banks in the country. It's located in Oklahoma. It does not have an office anywhere in New York State. They make their money by buying up at-risk mortgages. They buy mortgages knowing that there's a great likelihood that the houses are going to go in foreclosure because they know that that's where they'll make their money. So when we see that MidFirst has bought up a particular mortgage, we know that house is in trouble.
Here's an email from, before I get back to the phones, an email from Damon who says, sorry, let me pull this back up. Damon sends a note and just says, it sounds like what they're asking for is a society without rules. I always thought the rule was, don't buy a house you can't afford, and if you can't make payments, expect to be evicted. That's from Damon. Elizabeth, go ahead.
I just want to comment on Damon's...
his email, yep.
His email. My house was affordable when I bought it. The reason why I got and had hard times was because I had a loss of income. And when I negotiated or did a modification with the bank, my mortgage went from $600 to $900. Now, that's not affordable at that point. So this is something that the banks do, and they raise up the price when even when you do a modification. So it makes it even more unaffordable for you. So I didn't go into this knowing that, you know what, this 30-year mortgage, knowing that something would happen along the way. And something did. So that's
okay.
Basically.
And Ryan, I know you've heard that complaint from people before in the audience, so why don't you address that as well? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think we want a society with rules, and the rule is that people have human rights, and those human rights should be the first priority of anything. Right now, the place where there's no rules are for the banks. They basically are running roughshod. Since the foreclosure crisis, as Liz said, she talked about MidFirst Bank, but the other banks that were too big to fail are now even more too big to fail. They're much bigger, they're much more powerful, and where people are more...
The president disputes that. He says they're not as over-leveraged and as big too big to fail as it was.
Then the president would have to answer how, if Wells Fargo bought up five more banks since the foreclosure crisis, how's they're not bigger? I mean, they're clearly bigger, and there's no regulation to make them smaller. So it's just continuing that process over and over. So we do believe in society with rules, and those rules should be based on humans, living, breathing people, not some large corporate system that has no vested interest in any particular neighborhood or community. But the people here, Liz, Barbara, Julie, and myself, we live in neighborhoods and working, and we're real people, and we should be supporting the real people, the listeners. Those are the people who should be the first priority, not the bank.
All right, back to the phones we go, and let's try to keep moving quickly because we have a lot of people who want to weigh in. Richard in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Richard.
I've observed that vacant and boarded up houses frequently are listed as in tax arrears for 1 or 2 or 3 years. Perhaps that has something to do with the fact that you have not had any donations to the community land bank. What is the relationship between getting those substantial tax arrears paid or waived in order to allow donations to be made to the land bank?
I guess to clarify, so you're talking about vacant city-owned tax foreclosures, or are you talking about city-owned houses that people are living in that are behind on taxes?
That's correct, the latter.
So as far as people being behind on taxes, we do think there should be programs to allow people to make sure that payments are affordable and people can make arrangements to stay in their houses. As far as the land trust per se, it's really the fact that we've set up a structure is a relatively new thing. So there really hasn't even been a large public push for massive amount of donations or being pushed. But that's kind of the next step, and we think it should be incorporated into these structural programs such as the Poverty Initiative. And anything that's going to be massive investment, much of it that investment should be community controlled.
Very good. That's the agenda to be followed then. Thank you.
Richard, thanks for the phone call. Maggie in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Maggie.
Hi. I just wanted to applaud the work of Take Back the Land and all of the other groups that are working to sort of address this issue.
I wanted to speak before to the role of the police in all this. There was a movement several years ago about issuing a moratorium on foreclosure-related evictions, because the feeling of a lot of us in the community was that we actually have a double whammy, wherein you have banks that are exactly as Ryan said, right? Like, you have a set of rules that's applied to the people who have the lease, and then you have the people who are in a position of power who seem to have absolutely no rules and accountability. And then we actually have taxpayers who pay the salaries of our police and sheriffs. And those people, our tax money in the form of those salaries is being used to use our police to enforce the will of banks who are operating above and outside of the law. And I think that if the argument that the police are making, which I understand, is that they have to be the servants of the court, then I think that we need to make serious decisions about the way that we allocate resources as a community, whether we want to allocate those resources in order to help people and advance our community, or whether we want to continue to use community resources to enforce the will of banks on some of the most vulnerable people in our population. And I just want to extend my love and compassion to the people that are on your show that are losing their homes. It breaks my heart that people are coming forward to say, I'm in this situation, I hit hard times as any human being. And then we have emails saying that you should just expect that if you hit hard times, there's nothing and no one for you, and you should get tossed out of your home with your young son. I don't think that that's a sustainable way to view community, a sustainable way for us to operate as a society. And I want everyone on the show to know that not everyone feels that way. Many of us in the community absolutely understand that every person hits hard times, and you have our compassion and our support.
All right, Maggie, thanks for the phone call. And on that note, Dan emails the program and says, how can I be notified of when an unjust eviction foreclosure is taking place? He says if more people showed up to at least voice their concerns, maybe this would perhaps stop. So to Dan's email, Julie?
Sure. Thank you, Dan. We welcome you. We have a Facebook page, Take Back the Land Rochester, where you can get information. We also have a website, takebackthelandrock.org. And please just check either of those out. There's information on contacting us. We have we call it the eviction watch list with about 350 people on it now. We welcome more. Anytime we have an eviction coming up and a need to rally people, we send information through that list.
All right, let's try to get as many calls in as we can in the next few minutes. Let's keep it quick. Paul Irondequoit. Go ahead, Paul. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. We lost Paul. Let's try John in Webster. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Evan. Timely subject. About Mayor Warren's statements, I've heard her stammer and stutter before and attempt to gloss over things, but she did a horrible job today. Gant got preferential treatment, as far as I am concerned. He's an assemblyman. They probably just automatically gave him what he wanted. He should have been charged for the demolition of his home. And let's remember that Mayor Warren used to be his first assistant, if I remember correctly. Thank you, Evan.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate that. John's referring to, he said today, the comments that I played from Mayor Warren earlier this hour were from about 2 weeks ago on this program. I played a segment of sound in which she defended Assemblyman David Gant, who walked away from a rental property that he owned in Rochester, and it became an eyesore. And Julie, do you agree with him that at the very least, if you walk away from a rental property that you own and you put it on the city or the taxpayers, that you should have to pay for either demolition or upkeep?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, for some homeowners, that it becomes another debt, but that they're unable to pay. But yes, in his case, definitely he should be paying for it. And the fact that he was also given another grant for another house for $36,000 to work on another house that he was investing in is really a questionable idea.
Well, the mayor says the city's ethics office, which is supposed to be independent, investigated and found nothing wrong with that. Let me grab Joe in Rochester. Last call. Go ahead, Joe. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I'm calling to express my support for Take Back the Land. I love what these guys are doing. I think anyone who's ever lived next to a boarded-up house or on the same block as a boarded-up house or in the same neighborhood as a boarded-up house understands the importance of keeping people in their homes. And for the people who are taking sides with the bank, I guess I can't understand why you would take the side of a mindless, heartless corporation its only goal is profit over an actual living, breathing human being that's a member of your community. I mean, that's an appalling assumption to make, that the bank is correct and that your neighbor is in the wrong.
Well, Joe, thanks for the phone call. I know a lot of others have expressed similar sentiments. And so as we wrap up the hour, Julie, final thoughts from you. What do you want to leave with our community as we close the hour here?
I think that if you are one of those people who are threatened with losing your home, if you're undergoing foreclosure, you should know that there are options. Don't leave your home. Stay there and get in touch with people who can help you.
Take Back the Land is on Facebook, as you say, right. And there are ways to get in touch with them. And so we'll continue to follow these stories going forward. Our thanks to Julie Gelfand and Ryan Acuff from Take Back the Land. Thank you both for being here. Elizabeth McGriff and Barbara Horton, good luck to both of you. I know it has been a hard stretch for you, but you heard a lot of support from the community today.
Yes.
Thanks for being here. Short break, more Connections next.